Hey everyone, and welcome to Neighbor Science. I'm Peter DeBeer.
I'm Ryan Salisbury. I thought about singing, but no, I'm not gonna try.
Yeah, I have officially been convinced that I should never do that again.
I didn't even do anything.
No. My wife listens to our show, and she got home the other night, and she beat me relentlessly for like 2 hours, and not in the fun way, you know. So,
men are just as oppressed as women.
Yeah, I look. I won't be doing it anytime soon again. I apologize unequivocally.
Feminists are always talking about the patriarchy, but you know what about the matriarchy? Did you ever think of that?
Yeah. Emory. okay, so we are on to, what is this, episode 3 of our Capital as Power series.
Yeah, I think this might be the last one in this series. We're probably going to do more we'll definitely do more CASP episodes, but I think for the series where we're explaining the, you know, central ideas, I think this will wrap it up for us.
Yeah, look, there's lots of ideas that still relate and expand on what we have done already, and I'm sure those are going to come up in future episodes. But yeah, I think today's episode should pretty much wrap up the basics.
Yeah, I mean, I'm out of book. You know, this is the end of the book.
I thought you meant you're out of book, as in you have no money left with which to continue our endeavor. But
is book slang for money somewhere?
I've heard it used that way.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
It's weird that I'm surprised by that, because people call it like cheddar and shit like that. So I don't know.
Yeah, but there's also like bookies.
Who
deal with the gambling of money. So I think that might have something to do with it. Something. I don't know. Let's skip over that and let's focus on the stuff that matters here, Ryan.
Gambling is power. So this episode is about differential accumulation, which...
Differential accumulation? What's that, sir?
Might sound alien at first, but hopefully it'll be pretty intuitive once we're done with this. So the basic definition of differential accumulation is the rate of accumulation of one capitalist or business as compared to the average of all capitalists or businesses. So one of the central points of Bickler and Nitzan's thesis is that, contrary to the idea that Marxists and neoclassicals have, which is that capitalists try to maximize profit, what they actually do in reality, and you know, if you've ever seen like an earnings report or you know, been in a business meeting, then you might know this, but capitalists tend to compare themselves to other capitalists or the average capitalist. And so what they actually try to do in like what their actual goal is in business is to beat the average of all capitalists. So they want to accumulate wealth faster than other capitalists do. Does that make sense?
I suppose. Yeah. I suppose that sort of essentially explains how a company like Amazon can spend the majority of its existence making little
no profit
to no profit to like negative profit on the books,
right.
while all the while amassing they kept on accumulating other businesses and everything, so that on the books it showed no profit, but there was definitely an accumulation of wealth happening. And the way that they justify that to their board is to say, well, look, we're if you go and you take into account our capitalization, we're still outperforming every other capitalist out there.
Right. Yeah, they're looking at revenue, they're looking at market cap, and they're looking at market share.
Yeah.
They they care about profits insofar as, you know, that's where the actual money they can spend comes from. But, I mean, first of all, that's not the main thing they're paying attention to. And second of all, they're definitely not maximizing it as mainstream economic theories claim. So what they're actually doing is they're just comparing themselves to other businesses, or even to like the company that I work for, when they share like the earnings performance, what they do is they set a benchmark for the amount of revenue they expect to gain over the next year or quarter, and then they just say this exceeds expectations, or this meets expectations, or does not meet expectations. So they don't even really care about profit explicitly. They care way more about revenue.
Essentially, I think for those that for some reason still don't follow what we're busy saying, you can think of all capitalist business as con artistry. And your ineffective con artists are the guys that just play the short game, constantly just playing the short game, trying to maximize their profit. Whereas dominant capital tends to play the long con. They're not looking to make a quick buck. They're there to make all the bucks.
Yeah. In macroeconomics, usually economists care about aggregate measures. So they just look at measures for the whole of an economy or the whole of an industry, which means that they are, averaging or summing like businesses that do very, very well and businesses that do very, very poorly. So they're kind of swamping a lot of information that would otherwise give us insight into what they call the macro economy by, putting it together with less useful information. And so one of the important findings of Bickler and Nitzan's research was that disaggregated statistics can often tell us a lot more about than the typical aggregate figures used by contemporary economists in macroeconomics. And so
that doesn't mean that microeconomic theory necessarily is more informative. It just means that macroeconomic theories tend to actually hide the details of what's happening by using aggregate information rather than detailed information.
Yeah, micro looks at like individuals and like
micro
individual
is your
businesses.
Lemonade stand. Yeah, micro is your lemonade stand.
Yeah, exactly.
Macro
exactly.
Is the entire freaking economy.
Right. And the trick is they take these things from micro, which like you can develop a model of an individual in an economy, which I mean technically you can't because they reduce everything to one product for a market. But they basically take these conclusions from micro and then just like sort of add them together, and say like, oh, if we take this microeconomic thing and then just multiply it by the number of businesses in an economy, then that this is like how it should behave or whatever. I think we've covered the capital Cambridge Capital controversy, or maybe I covered it in the zine, but there's numerous problems with that. But this is different. This is not looking at individual businesses like on their own, or even like at all, really. It's looking at like the top like 10 or the top 200 businesses in an industry compared to all businesses in the industry or in the economy as a whole.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the Fortune 500, for instance, makes up so much of the economy that looking at the rest of them is not really very informative.
Right.
But if you look at what's happening with the Fortune 500, that's going to give you a very clear indicator of how the economy as a whole can be viewed.
Right. Yeah, I mean if you're putting Starbucks together with like a local cafe that's like a business, but not really a capitalist business, because they're not doing any of the things that dominant cap, like that huge corporations are doing, then you're losing a lot of insight. So like neoclassical economics begins with the assumption that competition works so well that all businesses are more or less equal. And so I think that's part of the reason they analyze things like this. But obviously in reality, business competition ends with pronounced winners and losers. There's, as Peter just said, you know, the Fortune 500 companies make up the vast majority of economic activity. And, you know, each individual, like other business outside of that, is kind of a tiny, tiny slice. And, you know, some people...
Sorry, I just want to be clear. Are we saying that my lemonade stand is not equal to Walmart?
Well, there's a lot of people that make the argument that
as much power as them.
All small businesses are like half of the economy or something like that. Like small business is like 40 or 50% of economic output or whatever. But the point is that like those businesses have very little influence on like politics and the shape of the economy in general.
Exactly. I'm also going to, this is going to be a little bit of a segue, and I'm hoping we can jump right back to here. But I was listening to something the other day on the BBC, which is some, when I was still busy administering online debate groups on Facebook. One of the debates I had was about what do people think about the government issuing a kind of salary to home caregivers. And Jesus, there was a lot of pushback on the idea, with people saying it's ridiculous, it's stupid, how would you even measure that? And it turns out, and I was listening to the BBC the other day where this exact topic came up, and there are political parties that are running on this platform in the UK, for instance, where essentially the estimate is that about 20% of the economy is completely unaccounted for because home caregivers are not being their labor is not being calculated by anyone.
Oh yeah, that's actually a really good Marxist feminist critique, which is that reproductive labor is not considered you know, labor even in Marxist economics, because it's not productive, it's reproductive.
So like on that basis alone, I will say that the claim that 50% of the economy is made up of small business is a load of shite. Because, I mean, literally the economy, there's no way that you can say small business makes up that much if, in fact, it was all based on a book called... Who Cooks Adam Smith's Dinner? I think that was the title of the book.
It's got to be his mom, right?
Yeah. And that was the essential argument. Apparently, and I've never read Adam Smith because, well, I tried and I fell asleep 43 or 44 times. And apparently, one of his arguments is about that no one gets their dinner for free, and people do all of that self-interest exists because people are going to charge for a dinner and so on and so forth. And this feminist economist basically did this book where she looked at this reproductive labor caregiver argument, and that on its own makes me say that, sorry, anyone who says that 50% of the economy is made up of small businesses is ignoring the fact that six media companies control the entire media market. And
yeah, they're looking at like the complete aggregate economy.
Exactly.
Instead of looking at any given industry.
Yeah.
You know, not all industries affect us equally, first of all. And, you know, most, if you look at like each industry on its own, almost all of them are controlled by a handful of businesses.
Yeah, so I can promise people that the shoe shine industry has never, even when they had hundreds of thousands of people all over the world running these small businesses of shining people's shoes, there was never a market for shoe shining that could even remotely match weapons manufacturers.
Yeah, and so despite the fact that you know, most industries are dominated by a handful of players, neoclassicals rarely, if ever, try to empirically determine what characteristics differentiate the dominant and the non-dominant players in those industries. And so they simply look at business as a whole. I think part of the reason for this is that economics is much more of an ideology meant to celebrate capitalism than a science meant to study it. And I mean, there are more scientific economists, but you know, once you get through 4 to 8 years of economics school, I think most people come out with their brains broken and are just looking to make models to show how great capitalism is, and they're not trying to do much in the way of studying it empirically. So much of Bickler and Nitzan's work and subsequent work by other scientists using the capitalist power framework has been to examine the differences between dominant and non-dominant businesses. So shifting the focus from the aggregate measures of the entire economy to differential measures of the top X businesses compared to all others produces a very different picture of the economy.
Indeed it does.
To differentially accumulate, or to accumulate in general, there's 4 possible ways that capitalists can increase their revenue and thus differentially accumulate. So to briefly just list all of them, number one is what we're most familiar with, new revenue sources, also called innovation, or, you know, creating new products, creating new services.
Because that's literally all of capitalism, if you were to ask a pro-capitalist.
Yeah, that's all it does. It just provides products for you. New ones every day, innovation, so et cetera.
So innovative.
Yeah, it's so fucking innovative. Number two is reduced costs, or what neoclassicals would call efficiency. This is what Marxists tend to focus on. They, you know, they acknowledge the new products part, but they are laser focused on examining how capitalists reduce costs, and usually at the expense of labor. Number three is increased prices, also known as inflation. And number four is acquiring existing revenue sources, also known as mergers and acquisitions, which can be abbreviated as M&A, which we'll probably use quite a lot. So that's the four. So we'll get into them in detail. So we'll start with new revenue sources. So a business can create a new revenue source by creating a new product or service and bringing it to market. This is what pro-capitalists consider the main source of revenue. So there's two problems with this. Sorry, there's three problems with this method. I wrote two and then thought of another one. Number one is the risk involved. Bringing a new product or service to market comes with inherent uncertainty and risk. For example,
like,
go ahead.
The pharmaceutical industry, where they don't actually fund most of their own research. Most of it is funded by taxpayer dollars.
Well, it's not taxpayer dollars, but I'll ignore that for now. So the examples I have are, I don't know how many people are going to remember this. I only remember and know about it because I worked at Best Buy at the time. But there was this phone from the 2000s called Helio that was supposed to be integrated with MySpace. This was kind of like just before smartphones really caught on, I think. And so they made this phone. It looks pretty ridiculous. Look it up if you want to see it. It looks pretty funny.
What's it called?
It's called Helio. Like Helios, like the sun,
more like Helio.
Similar to MySpace, it was a flop, although, you know, MySpace enjoyed some popularity before it failed. Helio was pretty much universally panned. People thought it was a silly idea. So it was a total failure. So that was, you know, obviously there was risk in trying to bring that product to market, and the risk did not pan out into a new source of revenue. We can also see many examples in the film industry where flop is a well-known term for a failed product. So today, the major film producers have learned how to avoid the risk of new film products by simply making sequels and remakes instead of original movies.
And, well, there is now an interesting new development on that front, and we've actually mentioned it on here before. When we were talking about Disney versus Netflix, and where companies like Paramount are now, they'll pump their money into the production of a film, but if they feel that there is even the slightest risk that it is going to flop at the box office, they'll sell it for international distribution rights to a company like Netflix.
Right, but they also they're not putting their money into those movies. They're putting money into the Marvel movies and the Star Wars movies because those are well-established hits. They always do well. So there's very little risk in creating new ones. And these independent movies or, you know, more original movies, they're just not getting nearly the same funding. Whereas if you compare it like the 90s, you have, you know, blockbuster movies were like Jurassic Park, Titanic, movies that, you know, were not sequels or remakes. They were adaptations, but, you know, they were still not movies that had been made before.
Agreed.
And so now they're not getting that money anymore. So number two, the second problem with creating new products is the cost of doing it. So creating a new thing has a significant cost associated with it. That's pretty obvious. You know, truly innovative products like the internet or the computer or things like that are almost invariably created by the government. So the government does they fund not only basic science, but, you know, create the really risky, like revolutionarily new products, and then capitalists just appropriate them and adapt them to markets so that they can, you know, sell them commercially.
University research departments are not funded by private corporations. What the private corporations tend to do is they look at anything that gets patented and they pay ridiculous amounts of money to the inventors of said patent, and then they go on to mass produce.
Right. And I think probably the only exception I can think of to this is like Xerox PARC, which actually did create a lot of like revolutionary technologies like the mouse and the graphic user interface. But then guess who actually brought that to market? It was Apple, not Xerox. So their production of a innovative new product didn't actually get them anything. It got Apple something. And I actually forgot that I used this in the next problem, which is the second mover advantage. So often new products are created by smaller companies trying to capture share in an industry, and that effort can just be copied by larger companies with more resources to expend to actually bring a product to market and to advertise it and market it and stuff. So as I just mentioned, Xerox PARC created the first computer with a mouse and a graphic user interface, and Apple just copied that and released it as the Lisa and made a boatload of money. An example we talked about on the news, the most recent news episode was the Magic Link, which was a PDA, which again was copied by Apple as the Newton. There are also plenty of tablets in existence for years. Microsoft made a bunch. A bunch of other companies made, you know, tons of them. And then they're copied by, again, Apple as the iPad. Noticing a pattern here. All of Apple's big hits are just copied from other people. And then there's also product crazes where someone will come out with this thing that everyone goes wild for a, you know, a hot minute, and then it kind of peters out right away. But you know, in the meantime, bunches of other companies copy what they're doing, and the costs go down, and so the people that were originally making it, you know, were charging, like the example I have here is fidget spinners, which I thought of this because of Your Kickstarter Sucks, my favorite comedy podcast. Fidget spinners started out at some crazy amount of money, like $20, and then fell like so fast to like a dollar or less, and you could get it at like the gas station. The companies with more manufacturing resources to utilize, you know, started making all these copies of fidget spinners and selling them for, you know, pennies.
I just have one objection here.
Uh-huh.
I vehemently object to describing something that goes from very popular to very unpopular as petering out. Okay, I find that offensive. And
all right, we'll call it debeering out.
That's really, now you're insulting my whole family. Like, dude. Look, I agree. I no longer use my fidget spinner. And I bought it when it was $20 each. So,
damn.
No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't. And I fear my wife enough to never spend that amount of money on something stupid.
I thought about getting one when they were like a dollar, because I was like, I don't know, they look kind of fun for a dollar, but I'm very resistant to buying stuff, so I didn't end up getting one. Okay, so capitalists do obviously create new products in order to stay competitive, because otherwise, you know, they would just be making the same thing, and businesses that do make new products would likely, you know, capture their market share.
But wait now. I'm sorry. What was the latest innovative product made by Apple?
The App Store?
Actually,
no, never mind. That's a repository.
Let's not do this, because we don't have that much time, and it would literally take a lifetime to try and think of the last thing that Apple did that was in any way innovative or original.
Right. Yeah. I mean, other than Apple, there's examples of companies doing innovative stuff. But anyway,
Sure.
Another example that I have here is one of Google's main products, which, you know, most of us would think of as pretty innovative, which is Google Maps. It's actually a composite of products acquired from lesser firms, and the list is pretty massive. So it started off as Where2 and Keyhole, and I actually remember when Keyhole got bought out in like the mid 2000s, but it was like, you know, they made Google Earth, which was really cool at the time. You know, you could like zoom around Earth, and
yeah, we all played with Google Earth.
Yeah, very gee whiz technology. It's also composed of ZipDash, which is a traffic analysis product, and Doxon, which is a mapping product, Image America, which is a aerial photography company, QuickSee, which does online video, Clever Sense, which does local recommendations, Waze, which does GPS navigation, Urban Engines, which does analytics, and Skybox Imaging, which is a satellite company. So they bought all these other companies and just kind of glommed them together into this super product that, you know, we think of as like, wow, this is one of the most revolutionary, you know, things that's changed our lives in the last 10 years or whatever. But it, they just sort of integrated it from others.
God damn it. I was sitting here thinking, you know what? Google did invent SketchUp. And so I had to look it up. And it turns out that SketchUp was developed by a startup company called At Last Software. And that was back
the only innovative thing the things they've done are AdSense and PageRank, which is their search algorithm.
Damn it. I really thought, because like when I first saw SketchUp, I was like, this is fucking amazing.
Is that the 3D modeling thing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because it's so extremely intuitive and user-friendly. Like, you literally draw a square, and from there, you can build an entire fucking universe. And
So the last example I have for new products not really being a thing is something we've mentioned before, which is Monsanto. Their BT crops were actually acquired from another business. So their flagship product, they didn't even make it themselves. So the next one is reduced costs, which again, they're both acknowledged by both main schools of mainstream economists. And heavily focused on by Marxists. But like new products, capitalists adopt technologies and practices to reduce costs in order to stay competitive. So once one business figures out how to reduce costs in a certain way, then others can just sort of adopt it. I think the only exception to this probably is what most people refer to as economies of scale. You can't exactly just adopt it yourself because it depends significantly on the size of your business. So like, as we mentioned, Apple pays like $20 per iPhone at the Foxconn factory. And you know, if a newer, smaller business were coming in trying to, you know, take over some market share from, you know, Apple and Samsung, they would be paying significantly more per unit of smartphone because they don't have the same purchasing power as Apple.
Okay,
so we're not going to get into that really because
reduced cost is stupid.
Just read about it somewhere else if you want to.
we all get that capitalists will over time increase the amount of labor that you do for the same amount of money, and that in the long run is a kind of extra exploitation, there's nothing new or groundbreaking here, and it's also not it doesn't feature very heavily in how they accumulate wealth and power.
We could mention that is, you know, kind of relevant to capitalist power would be subsidies from the government, mainstream economists consider this a distortion on the market and shouldn't be considered part of the equation of how businesses accumulate wealth and revenue and stuff. But obviously, subsidies are a widespread phenomenon. Businesses do lobby governments to get subsidies for their businesses. A lot of industries depend on subsidies, like the corn industry, and that does reduce their own costs. And you know, it's one of those things where it's another example of how you can't really meaningfully separate politics from economics. But we're not here to talk about innovation or cost reductions. We're here to talk about inflation and mergers and acquisitions. So we're going to start with inflation here. So I've talked to enough people about inflation to know that it's important to explain what exactly inflation is. I'm sure I've explained it many times on the podcast before, but I'm just going to do it again. Inflation is an increase in the price of a good or all goods in general over time. It is not, as some people say, too much money chasing too few goods, as in the quantity theory of money. If you disagree with that, feel free to prove me wrong by finding an example of any measure of inflation that is based on the money supply instead of the cost of products. So inflation is when capitalists raise prices on products. It is not anything else. It's not caused by the supply and demand of money, because supply and demand is supposed to explain prices, and prices are measured in money. And so to try and use supply and demand to explain the quote value of money doesn't make sense, because money doesn't have a price. Money is what measures prices.
But Ryan, look, I understand that you know things, or that you think you know things, but watching dogs chase their own tails is really fun.
So what's much easier, less risky, and less costly than trying to create a new product or to, you know, reduce your costs is to simply increase the flow of an existing source of revenue. This can be accomplished by raising the price of a good, of an established good, or reducing the unit size of the good, which is also known as shrinkflation. So this practice is so frequent and widespread, it happens at a relatively predictable rate that economists believe the central bank's rate of interest controls, which...
I think literally every single person on the planet, at once they've finished listening to this podcast, they can test this theory, okay? You can literally go to a store now, find a product that you enjoyed several years ago and have not had since, be it a chocolate bar or a bag of crisps or whatever, any kind of consumable good, and notice the very definitive difference in that specific product. They're either using some sort of cheaper product to achieve more or less the same product, but it's never quite the same. Your chocolates are slightly smaller. Your Skittles have a slightly different coating over them, so on and so forth. And all of this is a kind of shrinkflation.
Yeah. There's also the classic example.
I remember when the price of a steak used to be a nickel.
That kind of shit. You know, when old people talk about prices, that's what inflation is.
I can get a steak for a nickel, just not a very fucking big one.
This is the 1 gram porterhouse.
it's intended to feed a family of five.
What, five ants? What are you talking about?
No, five Africans.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's worth pointing out that inflation is also inherently redistributive. So the consumer, the poorer person, has to pay more for the same item, while the capitalist, the rich person, receives greater income without adding any value to it. So you are giving up more of your money for the same thing, which means the capitalist is receiving a greater flow of money, and you are losing a greater flow of money, which means inflation redistributes wealth from the poor to the rich. This is a really important insight in Bickler and Nitzan's work.
Basically, for all those people who think that inflation is too much money chasing too few goods, what you're busy saying is that the capitalist, who is not adding any value to their product but is getting more money back for producing exactly the same thing, is essentially, that's the government's fault. By saying that because they've increased the money supply, that devalues the stuff, and so the prices only seem to inflate. No. That's called passing the buck. At the end of the day, this is on capitalists. they're the ones that are sitting back saying, well, I'm not going to do much else, but I still want more money, so I'm just going to charge more. And you don't have a fucking choice because they all constantly charge more. That's why it's right. called an inflation rate.
Yeah.
It's something adopted by the entire market.
Yeah. And so this that makes it so clear why pro-capitalist ideologues are so interested in portraying inflation as an excess of money in circulation, because it does shift the blame of this constant rapacious form of redistribution away from the people that are actually doing it onto the government. And so, you know, when that manifests as policy, you know, when they go to set policy based on the idea that inflation is when the government creates too much money, what they end up doing is, you know, reducing the amount of public money going into people's pockets, which almost always ends up taking more money away from the poor. So there's like a double redistribution there, where inflation redistributes money from the poor to the rich, and then you know, as a response to inflation, based on this idea that it's the government creating money, there's cuts to public spending on, you know, social welfare. Or, you know, they'll, if not cuts, they'll at least like prevent any new social welfare programs from being created, because after all, who's going to pay for it? It's going to cause inflation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Again, I hope that my segue here doesn't distract us too much. I just very quickly want to say that I find this concept to be, and I hate this term as much as most of us do, it is problematic. And it is problematic because when you pass the buck this way, by blaming the government is easy to blame. Okay, it's very quick and easy, because people cannot conceive of a world that runs on governance rather than government, which is something we covered in the Adhocracy episode. Governance is not government. Okay, you don't specifically need the government in order to govern. Society is capable of governing itself. But because they're incapable of viewing that without thinking about free markets and a return to robber baron capitalism, they sort of then say, well, government is necessary. And because capitalists and pro-capitalists understand that people can't, they're afraid of a world without government, they then very quickly and easily push this blame onto the government, so that at that point people go, well, Okay. Well, then in that case, inflation is just, it's just something that it's unavoidable, and we just have to, you know, stick it out. And that's not the case.
Well, I mean, capitalists think that pro-capitalist ideologues think that inflation is actually good. Like I think I tweeted something about this. One of the examples that they give in, like on the Wikipedia article about inflation, is that collective bargaining or government policy can increase wages above, you know, so-called equilibrium, this nebulous concept of the correct value of something that neoclassicals blabber about incessantly. So they say that, you know, there's these high wages which are in disequilibrium, which leads to unemployment, which really means, you know, capitalists want to fire people so they don't have to pay as much money to workers because they're bastards. And so inflation is good because it artificially lowers wages, or it indirectly lowers wages, rather. And that puts employment back in equilibrium, because people are, you know, getting paid less in real terms, and so now like more people can be hired.
Well,
so they're ignoring the fact that inflation is done by capitalists, and the reason that they can hire more people because of it is because they're making more money from the same thing. So they're extracting money from the workers.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I'm very much considering starting up a capitalist business and then only employing pro-capitalists who obviously are very okay with me over a span of time just constantly reducing their wages to the point where they basically have to live off nothing. And then at that point they can join the movement that hates on themselves for using food stamps to live.
Well, they can just move somewhere else and get a better job if they don't like it. So
yeah, come pull your bootstraps up in Thailand or something.
Yeah. So examples of inflation are pretty familiar to us. In the U.S., the price of college tuition has increased by over 500% since 1985. And I think we discussed the causes of that on the last episode. And similarly, the cost of healthcare has increased over 300%. And classic capitalist ideologue fashion, they blamed this on the Affordable Care Act. So if you look at a graph of inflation of healthcare, it has been increasing steadily for decades. But because not everyone remembers this, or not everyone realizes that inflation is just this constant thing that always happens, people remember like, oh yeah, I remember when Obamacare started. And then they look at like, oh yeah, the price of my insurance has gone up, and so it must be because of Obamacare. and then also, like, a lot of people didn't even have insurance before that. You know, it put like tens of millions of people on insurance that didn't have it before. And so, like, when it first started, you know, they paid, you know, X amount of money, and then the next year they had to pay even more because the cost of insurance just inflates constantly. And so they didn't even have a reference point pre-Obamacare because they just didn't have insurance at all.
God.
Examples of shrinkflation, which again is when the unit size of a product is reduced, but the price is kept the same, is that Coca-Cola changed its 2-liter bottles of soda to 1.75 liters without changing the price.
When did they do this?
I think it was 2014.
I do remember at one stage there were 2-liter bottles, and then at a later stage I sort of remember there was a 1.75-liter bottle. But because I don't drink Coca-Cola,
Use it to clean your toilet.
Yeah, sometimes. Okay, look, these are all great examples, but I think I really want us to rather talk about stagflation.
Right. So.
I find this a lot more interesting.
Yeah. So there's a more specific type of inflation called stagflation, which is inflation accompanied by stagnation. In other words, low, no, or negative growth. It's a recognized phenomenon by mainstream economists, but they just consider it an anomaly. They consider it a sign that an economy is starting to fail. So they would think of the best example of stagflation of as being like Zimbabwe, when the Zimbabwe dollar was inflating when they had hyperinflation and then no growth in the economy.
And a really good example from right now is Argentina, who has they've really been struggling with their inflation rate since the last time that the IMF. Bailed them out, and they ended up defaulting on the loan to the IMF. And so it got to the point where the inflation started running away from them, and that led to a tipping point where the unemployment rate then starts going up, and it becomes really difficult to solve that kind of stagflation. And what's now happened is that Argentina has once again gone to the IMF to ask for some money, and they did this without, you know, having a national discussion in Argentina, and you know, there were no discussions about it. And the main problem with that is the fact that the Argentinian people absolutely loathe the IMF. They blame them They blame them for everything that's gone wrong, and rightfully so, in the last 20 years in Argentina, and all of it because
Mainstream economists consider stagflation anomalous. But as Bickler and Nitzan show, stagflation is actually the norm in the capitalist system. They measure stagflation as the average of the standard deviation of unemployment and the standard deviation of inflation. So they take those two standard deviations and average them together. And I don't know all the reasons for this. They might explain it in the book, but I was trying to read pretty quickly. I think I put this in yesterday. I think the reason that they do this is because, as we talked about in the episode with Blair Fix, measuring growth using capitalist terms is innately rife with problems, because you can't exactly measure growth. Like, what is growing in the economy? You know, it's very unclear. So unemployment is a good proxy for this, because as the economy grows, it's going to start to employ more people. And so as an example of stagflation, I would cite like the last 10 years of the U.S. economy, where unemployment has been quite high. I mean, if you look at the actual unemployment numbers, that's probably not reflected very well through that. But if you look at the labor force participation rate, it's somewhere around 60%, which is very low. But, you know, despite that, we've had quite a lot of inflation in the last 10 years.
Okay, well, just want to point out, because South Africa for a long time has struggled with a really high unemployment rate. And by high, I mean...
double like, digits.
Oh yeah, more than double digits.
Triple digits?
Yeah, it's just people when, have when negative people jobs. Say double digits. The moment people say double digits, and I have found that the standard assumption is that, oh my God, you're talking like 10-11%, and I'm like, no, more than that. The current unemployment rate in South Africa is 26.6%.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So back to stagflation. The reason that Bickler and Nitzan say that stagflation is the norm and is important to capitalist accumulation is because of this differential analysis that they do. So they took the top, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's the top 100 corporations, and looked at how much they performed inflation compared to the average of all corporations. And so basically the corporations that engage in more inflation tend to be the ones that differentially accumulate the most. So the ones that are at the bottom, you know, they're keeping their prices lower, whereas the ones at the top are raising their prices as much as they can. Okay, so I think we've covered inflation there. So we'll move on to mergers and acquisitions.
Which for me is the most interesting of them all. Mostly because it's a point of news that I can easily follow.
It gets covered a lot.
I can subscribe to Reuters and CNBC.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to follow price changes than to follow M&A.
Yeah, no fucking kidding. I've tried to follow inflation, and it's just none of it makes any fucking sense.
Yeah. So mergers and acquisitions are by far the best way for a business to increase differential accumulation. M&A allows a business whose goal is building hierarchies and revenue streams to purchase entire intact hierarchies and revenue streams. So rather than trying to create new products or services and build a company up themselves, capitalists can simply allow smaller companies to build companies and hierarchies and revenue streams themselves and then just buy them. So this makes a lot of sense out of the Silicon Valley model, which, you know, a lot of people think is like insane, where you know, people create these startups and then just let themselves get bought out. But it makes sense from both perspectives. So if you want to strike gold on your own, the safest way to do it is to come up with some product that a much larger company will want and then just sell your entire business to them. Whereas if you're a large company, the safest way to, you know, quote, innovate is to simply let the little people take on the risk of creating something new and buy them out when things happen to work out for them. So we noted the example of Google Maps, which is just a big amalgamation of companies doing exactly this. So Google just bought a bunch of other companies and glommed them together. And there's actually, I got that list from the Wikipedia article on, I think it's a list of mergers and acquisitions by Google or by Alphabet. So if you look that up, the list is insanely huge. All of their products are made like this, with the exception, like I said, of I think PageRank and AdSense. That might even be bought up by someone else, though. I don't know. So one of the strongest pieces of quantitative evidence for mergers and acquisitions being about power instead of you know, production, as mainstream economists, including Marxist economists, would claim, is the relationship between an index called Tobin's Q and the buy to build indicator, which is a metric created by Bickler and Nitzan. So the buy to build indicator is defined as the value of mergers and acquisitions as a percentage of gross capital formation. So they take all capitalization and make a ratio out of it by taking just mergers and acquisitions, like the growth in capitalization from mergers and acquisitions as a percentage of the growth in all capital. And so that describes whether capital is being bought mostly, which mergers and acquisitions would be when capital is being bought, or whether it's being built, which all other types of capital formation would be building. And then the Tobin's Q describes whether capital is cheaper to buy or build. And that number is defined as the ratio of total market value of the firm divided by the total asset value of the firm. So like the stuff that they actually have is their assets, and then the total market value is their actual market cap. So if it's normalized to one, I guess. No, that's not even the right term. Basically, if it's greater than one, then the company is valued as being greater than just the sum of their assets, which according to neoclassical economics should not happen. That it would be considered in disequilibrium if that were the case, because all a business is an entity that produces products, and so the assets that they have are the only thing that they're actually worth. And if it's less than one, then the company is valued as, you know, less than the assets that they have. But I think on average, Tobin's Q is greater than one, like for you know, over the long term, which kind of, you know, disproves that idea that it's just in disequilibrium, and that, you know, the real value of a firm is simply the value of its assets.
I just want to be clear here. So when Tobin's Q is greater than one, it indicates that the company is worth more than the sum of all its assets. And when it is less than one, the company is worth less than the sum, than the total sum of its assets. Okay. So then, if I'm a neoclassicist, then, or even just a mainstream economist these days, if I'm then looking at this from rational, and then as rational actor theory, when it's worth less, that's the right time to buy it, right?
Right. Yeah. So if it's less than one, it's as if the company is on sale, because you'd be able to get all these assets for less than they're actually worth by buying the company.
Yeah. And then obviously if Tobin's Q is greater than one, at that point I'm going, it's overpriced.
It's like one of them damn beanie babies. It's overpriced, you know?
It's like Tobin's Q for the fidget spinner, when it was greater than one, no one wanted it. But the moment it went less than one, then everyone wanted it, right?
Exactly.
Except that's not what actually happened.
Right. So if neoclassical or Marxist theory held true, then corporations would buy capital, which according to them, again, is means of production. Corporations would buy capital when it's cheap, and build it when it's expensive. So if the buy to build indicator is high when Tobin's Q is low, then that would prove neoclassical and Marxist theory to be correct, because capitalists would be buying capital when it's cheap and building when it's expensive. Unfortunately, that's not actually the case. So I'll include the chart here in the show notes. But if you look at the chart, capitalists very clearly buy capital when it's expensive and build it when it's cheap. So if we treat the logic of capitalism as being based on maximizing profit in the present by acquiring means of production and selling products, then this behavior is completely irrational. But if we treat the logic of capitalism as being based on beating other capitalists at accumulating revenue based on expected future income, then buying capital when it's expensive makes perfect sense, because the most expensive capital is expected to generate the most revenue in the future.
Okay. So, sorry, I'm not but a simple-minded person, so I'm going to keep going back to fidget spinners here. So the moment that the fidget spinner Tobin's Q went over one, capitalists bought.
Right. So when fidget spinners were priced high and they were selling, then businesses realized, people are going to be buying this in the future. And so they would sell it themselves. It's not the best example because, obviously fidget spinners are not a capital asset. So that's not exactly how they're priced. But
the way I'm busy picturing it now in my head, and this is why I say I'm a simpleton. So the moment that price of the fidget spinner started inching up, the capitalists bought it knowing that, although it's a fad, it's valuable. It's not something that's not valuable.
Yeah.
Which is what they don't want. They don't want to buy something that's not valuable.
Right.
And so while the price was above the specific arbitrary level that they said, while it was above there, they kept cashing in. But the moment that it dipped under there, the moment it started selling, or just before it started selling at a dollar each, they would have sold that off. And then the small guys who don't understand how capitalism works keep investing in the product. and keep selling it because they think, well, it's a fad and we'll capitalize on that. But what they're not capitalisming properly.
Yeah, I think a really good example could just be one that we've talked about, which is Bitcoin, where when the price of Bitcoin was like $1 per Bitcoin, nobody was buying it. But once it started going up and up, and Bitcoin started being valued higher, then more and more people started buying it at those higher prices because they expected it to continue going up, because that's how Bitcoin is actually valued, which is the expectation that it's going to continue getting more valuable.
Mm. And notice how nobody buys Bitcoin when it is at a low. They only buy it when it is busy rising.
Right.
This is something that can actually be exploited quite heavily and often is, and that's the whole reason why pump and dump works so well with
Bitcoin.
With the stuff, not just Bitcoin, but a lot of stuff that's similar in concept to Bitcoin. I suppose the entire capitalist market can be described in similar terms.
Yeah. Okay. So again, returning to the differential analysis, companies that engage in more M&A activity tend to be the dominant capitalists compared to all other capitalists. So if you look at the top 100 corporations, you can expect to see that they have engaged in a lot more merger and acquisition activity than the average.
I think the perfect example of this right now is Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they're the ones that are dominating box office incomes. Year after year, they have the best performing movies in the box office because they have figured out that you just redo what everyone else does. But they are also the only ones that have been buying up the other companies that are making money. They bought Pixar. Because Pixar was showing itself to be very valuable. Yep. They then bought Marvel because and please note that they didn't buy Marvel and then Iron Man came out and started off a global franchise that resulted in the most profitable movie of all time. They waited and they saw, oh wait, Marvel has brought out something that is really valuable. Let's step in and buy out Marvel and we'll make money that way. And now there's the Fox deal happening.
And Star Wars.
Yeah, they bought out Lucasfilm as well. So I think they're a fantastic example of how mergers and acquisitions are a strong indicator of who has the most power.
Yeah, and again, they're the only ones that are making blockbuster movies, or those are the only blockbuster movies that are getting made, is the ones that got acquired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely, Silicon Valley has a lot of really good examples of mergers and acquisitions specifically. Look at Facebook. They see Instagram is doing really well and starting to become valuable. Buy them. I know most Americans haven't heard of WhatsApp.
Yeah.
So
the last thing I have is kind of the integration of the two main methods of accumulation. Because I don't know if I made this clear, but both mergers and acquisitions and inflation explain which capitalists or which corporations are dominant far better than new products or cost reductions do. Using the differential analysis, the you know, there's not much difference in cost reduction for, you know, dominant capitalists, but there is a huge difference for both inflation and M&A. And so those two together have a certain phenomenon where they sort of operate like counter-cyclically. So when the rate of mergers and acquisitions is high, then the rate of stagflation tends to be low, and vice versa. So there's this graph that I've included in the show notes. And I believe in this graph, stagflation is inverted. So while it looks like the trend kind of matches, it's actually inverted. So they operate counter to each other. So we can kind of predict when if mergers and acquisitions are falling, then we can predict that inflation will rise. Let's see. Sorry, I'm trying to back up here. So all accumulation is conflictual, but not all paths to accumulation are equally so. Mergers and acquisitions are not only the most effective way to differentially accumulate, they are also the least conflictual. I mean, other than new products. The average person is barely affected by mergers and acquisitions and probably doesn't notice it until long after the fact. Unless you're like me and you're in a company that is acquired by another and then like changes to a new company all of a sudden. Inflation, on the other hand, is readily noticeable to the average person. Old people complain about it all the time, and it directly harms them by redistributing money from them to the rich. So inflation is more conflictual and tends to encounter more resistance than mergers and acquisitions. Capitalists prefer the path of least resistance to accumulation, so they will prefer mergers and acquisitions over inflation. And so Bickler and Nitzan have found that there is a cycle, like the well-known business cycle, that alternates between waves of mergers and acquisitions and waves of stagflation.
Okay. So, I've got this really stupid image in my mind now of if capital is power, then capitalists are electricity, because they take the path of least resistance. I don't know. I really am a simpleton.
Yeah, I mean, we're both big stupid idiots, but that's okay. You know, we read a lot of stuff, so we can sound smart. That's why I read anyway.
Well, I read so that no one asks me to do stuff because I can look at them and say, I'm busy.
All right. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Again, we are Neighbor Science. If you forgot the name of the podcast that you searched for and clicked subscribe on and heard in the beginning of the episode, I'm Ryan. Well, that's Peter.
Come on, Ryan. Come on.
You can
Ryan.
Follow us. Go ahead.
Sorry, I just want to point out that we might, for all we know, have a lot of Alzheimer's patients that listen to our show. And
come on.
a gentle reminder at the end is not going to hurt anyone. Also, I have a really bad memory. I sometimes forget what I'm busy doing.
Yeah.
While I'm doing
it. So, you can follow us at NeighborSciPod on Twitter, all other social media platforms. We're just Neighbor Science. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/neighborscience. What else? Oh, the website is postscarcitymagazine.com. The podcast is on there, as well as the zine that I've been doing for the past bunch of years. I'm at Handle of Rye, and Peter is at BookCheekite.
On yep. Twitter, yeah. Other than that, hope you've enjoyed the episode. I apologize for being an idiot. And I apologize for Ryan being so bloody smart and knowing so
I'm
much
not that smart.
About big words.
Oh, if you subscribe to the Patreon at any level, I put outtakes on there. So currently we're at 1 hour 51, and so I'm definitely going to be cutting stuff out. So if you want to hear stuff that didn't make it into the show, then you can support us on Patreon for a dollar or more, and there will be outtakes that you can listen to there. So
awesome.
Yep, that's it. Bye.
Bye.